Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hey, what up? Welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball. And with the NCAA tournament continuing on, I think you're really going to like this one. Joe Gallo is the head coach of Merrimack. You're like, wait, how do I know that name? Well, as you're watching FDU pull off an improbable upset of Purdue, the team that actually won the NEC, beat FDU in the NEC's championship game, is his Merrimack team. But they're not eligible to go because they're in the transition phase, transitioning to Division One. Crazy as it may seem, it's got to be just a weird existence to be watching a team go through a run that you probably thought that could be me. We'll ask Joe about it. He's going to join me upcoming. Quickly, I wanted to give you some thoughts on Purdue losing to FDU. If you follow me on social media, at Gottlieb Show, Twitter, Instagram, there's the Doug Gottlieb Show fan page on Facebook, you know this to be true. I've become a proponent of five-out basketball. Five-out basketball, to those of you who aren't hoopers, it's a lot of times you go and see AAU teams, right, where they're just all five standing outside the three-point line. But yeah, that's the basis of it. You're always playing five-out. You can flash somebody in the post. I like cutters within it. I like a design, plan, continuity sort of offense with as few a dribble handoffs and ball screens as possible. Not because I'm anti-dribble handoff and ball screen guy, but because so many teams set their defense to your ball screen coverage, to your DHO coverage. Anyway, without getting too much in the weeds, that's basically how FDU plays combined with full court pressure. And that's really the story of the game was not their offense, although I do think that their offense helped them with dagger shots. Also, because of the continuous movement, it tires you out. You know, it's kind of like guarding Princeton back in the day. There's constantly cutting, constant movement. You don't know what's coming next because it's not a plan, set, pattern offense. And when you get tired of guarding on defense, it hurts you offensively. But their defense was outstanding, and it was really their game plan. They picked up Braden Smith and rattled him. He had 7 turnovers. Within the half court, they sagged off of especially the 4 men for Purdue and dared them to shoot. And when the dares were taken, they didn't make it. And then there was a good portion of the game where Purdue got super tight and wouldn't even look at the basket. My thoughts on Purdue is like, I know people so badly want them to dramatically change. And if you've listened to this podcast, we talked about a conversation I had with Tony Bennett after they lost to a 16 seed. And how I challenged him, I said, you know, have you ever thought you got to be willing to lose a game in November and December to win a game in March? And by that, I mean, try different lineups. See what it looks like to play small. Take a look at a zone. I mean, the first thing is I definitely would have played zone yesterday. Why are we making our 7'4" center run around the court, try and chase a guy he can't guard? And though it shouldn't be your primary defense, you do want to have it in your back pocket just in case for just that sort of matchup. Different variances of man-to-man are great, but so too is the zone. And I don't like zone at all, but you got to have it in your back pocket. The other part to it is that I would have challenged him to continue to put more and more shooters out there. You know, they always played with one of their 2-4 men or Mason Gillis. And when they didn't have Zach Edey in the game, they'd always have his backup in the game because it's technically a smaller lineup. But why can't you play Mason Gillis at the 5? Why can't you play 5 out in your own right? In regards to their guards and not having multiple ball handlers, guys that can break down a defense, I think some of it is the reality to Purdue. Purdue is not wired like some of these programs to go out and get a guy at the portal and play him right away. You're not going to be able to get a guy who breaks down a defense, who creates things, a high-level portal point guard, who wants to be a Purdue sort of guy. They've done a very good job of keeping it within their sort of culture. Maybe you step out of it some. But the problem is, if you take guys that don't fit your culture, oftentimes that's what's led to these disastrous seasons. All that said, it was still a winnable basketball game. And between how much help was on Zach Edey and their inability to get in the ball, and then Edey got the ball a couple times late, and he still didn't even look at the basket. All of that stuff going on, I thought, was a team that lacked confidence. And part of it is, now it's 3 years in a row, they've had these defeats, and it does wear on you. I would also tell you that, you know, like, look, if you want to be honest, I don't think Zach Edey has ever known what it's like to be a dominant player on his team. Like, that's a different role for him. He's never been that guy. You have to learn those things over time. You have to learn that, you know, there are times when you got to take bad shots. You get double teamed, shoot the ball, because that allows you to rebound on the weak side. He became passive. They became passive. Nobody wanted to shoot the basketball. But to people who want to say that this somehow, you know, means that Tony Bennett or Matt Painter's programs are fraudulent, what you don't understand is it's almost two different sports, especially in the Big Ten. To win the Big Ten, generally, you got to be able to score and defend inside. You need big dudes. You do. Big Ten football was like this for years, where you couldn't win in the Big Ten unless you could run the football and stop the run. On the other hand, when you get out of the Big Ten, now the other teams have way more speed than you have. Way more. Way more. And I think that the Big Ten, at least Ohio State, has evolved. Michigan's evolved some in football. They need that same sort of evolution, which you're seeing at Penn State in basketball. Let's get to this discussion. Merrimack's an amazing story because they should be playing in the NCAA tournament, but there is a rule of transitioning to Division I. Today, the day after this gigantic upset, I got a chance to catch up with Joe Gallo, Merrimack's head coach, and he's an alum. This is how it went. So I like to do chronological order and start with your career at Merrimack. Yeah. But I don't want to bury the lead. Okay. What's the last, I don't know what this has been, 12, 20 hours been like watching the school that you beat,
yeah,
to win the conference tournament championship take down Purdue?
You know, a lot of it's been more from the outside, right? Friends and, you know, former teammates and former colleagues and kind of responding to a lot of other people's emotion about the situation, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, you sit there and watch and you picture your own team in that situation. But it's been it's kind of been 4 years in the coming. Like, everybody is just finding out for this rule for the first time, really, because of us. I think it's something that myself and our staff prepared for mentally. It hits home a little more when you actually see the team out there playing. But I feel a lot better than people would probably think, to be perfectly honest with you. Like, when you text me and I wrote back, that was a true story. I was watching the Merrimack UMass Lowell semifinal Hockey East game. that we won in double overtime to go to the finals against BU in the Garden tonight, which I'm going to be heading out in a few here. So, you know, no hard feelings. I've known Tobin Anderson for a long time. When he was at Stack and we were D2 Merrimack, he knocked us out of a Division II NCAA tournament my first year as the head coach. Since that game, we've scrimmaged every year since. You know, they press, we play zone. No one wants to scrimmage either one of our teams, right? We got together and said, you know what? If we play you in October, we'll have all our press stuff in. And if you play us, you'll have all your zone stuff in. And we've played ever since. So, you know, I think the reaction most people are looking for aren't what they're going to get out of me. I'm happy for them. I'm happy for the league. I think people really kind of shit on our league a lot this year. You know, when every team's playing 4 or 5 guarantee games and your league starts out 0-40, your metrics are never going to catch up to the league, right? And it's like they go and do what they did, not only in that game. I mean, they 20-piece Texas Southern and it wasn't even close. So I think for them to do that gives our league a little more credibility. And hey, you know, I feel bad for our guys because, like I just told you, last time I saw you was when I was an assistant at Robert Morris when we played North Florida. I'm fortunate enough to experience the whole deal of March Madness. Unfortunately, our players won't get to do that. That's the one thing I really do feel bad for. But, you know, let's have FDU keep winning and have Merrimack's name keep getting put out there because of it.
Okay, so is there a team group text that you're on?
There is, but we haven't touched it. To be honest, our guys don't want to watch. They say, I can't watch this, is where they go with it.
I can't blame. Like, I don't know if you experienced this when you were in the tournament, but when you're in the tournament and you lose, you don't want to watch. What?
Right? It's just over.
It hurts too,
like,
bad.
To me, basketball season is over.
So let's go back.
Okay.
So you grew up in Jersey.
I did.
You go to Princeton Day.
Yep, I went to Bishop Barre, which is now St. Thomas Aquinas in Edison, New Jersey, Middlesex County. And then I finished my last 2 years at Princeton Day School.
So was Princeton Day School, the image I paint is everything is like Princeton Junior, like you even run chin and elbow in high school. Is that accurate?
It's pretty accurate. Legendary high school coach, Alan Tabak. He was a close friend of Pete Carrill. We did run a lot of Princeton stuff, it's right up the road, and it's basically a JV Princeton is what it is.
What do you remember about, and or do you remember about the last Princeton win? Because my connection to it is that would have been my freshman year at UCLA. I was a lifetime UCLA fan. They offered me a scholarship and went to Notre Dame instead. Yep. And then one of the players who's really waving the towel more than anything on that team, Darren Height. You'll love this. So Darren Height, we played together from fourth grade on, and he was an unsigned senior.
Yep.
And he played at Modern Day, and he was like a jack of all trades, master of none, right? Probably averaged 6-7 a game. And he couldn't get in on his own. He couldn't get into Harvard, Princeton, Yale. And I mean, you know, like back then, 1400 plus SAT, 4 whatever GPA, just couldn't get in. And my dad calls Coach Carrill and says, Pete, you got to take this kid. He's perfect for you. You know, parents can afford it. Dad's a periodontist. So he's like, I don't know. I don't need a California kid. So he comes out, and on Friday night, we practice at Modern Day, and you can't really tell in a practice. So the next day we play a game, and, you know, we have like Tony Gonzalez and J.R. Henderson and Miles Simon. And we got a squad.
Yeah.
And we decide that everything we do, we're going to do for Darren, right? We're going to run him off single doubles. You know, he's going to play the point. Gonna do it. He's got like 30 end of like the third quarter. And my dad had a rule where, like, if you take yourself out, you can put yourself back in, right? So he's tired. He takes himself out. And then mid fourth quarter, he tries to like put himself back in. My dad's like, where are you going? He's like, what do you mean? I'm going back in the game. You know, we had the rule. I took myself out. I go, no, no, no. Sit your ass down. You're going to Princeton. Sure enough, he goes to Princeton. So if you watch that game, there's a 44 on the sideline waving the towel on that last back door. What do you remember about that game?
I was young.
How old were you? You were young. You're like middle school?
I was born in 80.
Okay, so you were You were 17?
No, that was that?
Yeah. Yeah. That was not, no, that was 90, 96. So you're 16.
16. Yeah. Yeah. I remember just as a Jersey guy and a kind of a hoops junkie at the time, you know, I didn't really, so I transferred there as an 18. I actually repeated my junior year. So 18 year old, I was there 18, 19. That's when I really.
You were a mid high school career holdback? I was a holdback in eighth grade.
Holdback, yeah.
Do you get to play 5 years in Jersey?
If you go to a prep school.
Oh, so it's a prep.
Yeah, it's a prep. It's not an overnight prep. It's prep. But that's when I really hopped in. I used to work their camps, you know, Coach Carmody. You know, I funny story about Coach Carrill. I was working their camp. I think Brian Earl, who's now the head coach, you know, he was an assistant at the time. I want to say Sidney Johnson was the head coach, and I'd always work their camps, and we're doing like a 3-on-3 station. And Coach Carrill was there watching, and he was with the Kings at the time. And he stops the whole segment, and Earl and Sidney, everyone's kind of looking like, what's about to happen here? And at the time, Jason Williams, White Chocolate, was their point guard. And Coach Carrill, which no one would ever think with all the fundamentals, he gets out there and he starts whipping behind the back passes off pick and rolls as, like, you know, he's probably 70 some at the time. And he goes, no, this is the best way to get it there. And Coach Carrill's whipping behind the back passes off the pick and roll. So, you know, I really got into the Princeton stuff after heading there. I was a Middlesex County guy. I'm a huge Rutgers fan. We had Rutgers season tickets. You know, I didn't hop on the Princeton stuff until I actually transferred down that way.
Our first Big East road game was against Rutgers at the Rack. Lost a 14 point lead and lost in overtime at the Rack. So I know it well. At the time, worst visitor locker room I'd ever experienced. I'd never seen anything like it. It was such a shit show.
They've done. We played there last year. It's much upgraded.
Yeah, no, they had to with the Big Ten thing. Why'd you go to Merrimack? What was it like at the time? What drew you to go into Merrimack College?
So I started at a Mass College of Liberal Arts Division III school. I had two really good teammates in high school, a kid by the name of Justin Leith, who went to UNC Wilmington to play for Jerry Wainwright, and a kid named Pierre Downing went to Florida Atlantic. I think Sidney Green was the coach at the time. And Justin, it was, you know, at that time, if you went from one to two, you didn't have to sit. So Justin was at UNC Wilmington. Not playing a ton. Greg Herenda, who's a Merrimack alum, was an assistant at East Carolina for Bill Harry. And there's a lot of Merrimack here. And he went up to, you know, he kind of almost poached Justin in the handshake line playing UNC Wilmington, sending him to Merrimack. Right. So he my high school teammate goes to Merrimack. He visits. He calls me. He says, this place is awesome. I had a great visit. And next thing you know, all three of us ended up at the same place. And I've kind of been there ever since. I played for
who's the coach?
His name is Bert Hamill. He passed a few years ago. Court's named after him. He coached there for 42 years. And it's how I got into coaching is Bert. He only hired former players.
Former players, yeah.
And, you know, in Division II, you get one full-time assistant. I was 8 months out of college. I had no business, you know, no experience to be a college head coach. But because of Bert only hiring former players, he gave me an opportunity and kind of took the opportunity and ran with it.
So what was the school like when you went to it?
So 1800 undergrads when I graduated in 2004, right? Always a great place to go to school because of the people. 20 miles north of Boston, pretty social place, kind of cool little party school, to be honest with you. It was always a fun place. Since that time, you know, we have a new president the last 10 years, Dr. Chris Hopi. The school is grown like crazy now. We're almost at five, you know, we're over 5,000 students with graduate students, new buildings everywhere. Just put a bowling alley, golf simulators on campus. Like the Merrimack I went to and the Merrimack now are two completely different places.
What was he like as a coach?
He was the ultimate look after my players coach. You know, I think, the best thing I learned from Bert is, you know, his office door was always open no matter what was going on. He's dropping whatever he's doing, you know, to hang with his guys. He coached you hard, you know, he was tough on us, old school guy, old school New York City guy. But then he always hugged you afterwards and you could go in there and talk to him about anything. He ran unbelievable practices. Everything was time and score, you know, not a ton of X and O, Bob Knight motion, man to man. But every drill, you know, full court one-on-one until you pass out basically type of guy, and time and a score on every single drill you do. And, you know, the biggest stat he kept in practice was wins and losses, not as much, you know, the true box score stats. And there's a lot to be said for that. You know, I think if you can take that competitiveness and add it with some of your own strategy and personality, it becomes a pretty good model for success.
How good were you guys?
Just okay. Just okay. 500-ish. I think we just missed the NCAA tournament. I think the top eight teams in the region make it. My senior year, we were probably 10th or 11th in the region. So it was, and then when I came back as an assistant, program even started to take off a little more. We went to three straight NCAA tournaments. From there, I left.
I just needed better guards. That's all it was.
We just needed better guards. Yeah, our front court was loaded. We needed better guards.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game. Everyone, please welcome Coach John Calipari.
We're getting beat by 18. My first game in Kentucky. They're saying Cal's a bust. He can't coach. This is crazy. John Wall runs down the floor and makes a buzzer beater.
Yep.
You remember that, John?
That's my first game win I ever made. Remember you said you never seen me do that.
Ladies and gentlemen, DeMarcus Boogie Cousins.
I called Boogie. I'm like, yo, bro, I'm about to commit to Duke. And I hung up on him. Bro, I'm talking about, do you want to tell me how many times he called me all type of names? Bro, you really sold me out. You doing this.
Bro, I was sick. I remember that like yesterday, man.
Love you, John Wall.
Thanks, Coach. Love you, too.
You made me everything I am today.
Nah, you made me. You made me.
I love it. Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It wasn't even supposed to do my name.
That's my game.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
What was your plan, or what would your family think your plan should be in terms of post-college before you decide to get into coaching?
I was going home to teach. I was a business management major. And I had no idea what I wanted to do. I went home, and I was, New Jersey has a, it's called the alternate route. I started taking teaching classes, took an exam. I was a substitute teacher. I was coaching high school, actually, for a Princeton guy. Ahmed El Nakali was their starting point guard at Princeton for years. He was the head coach at Princeton Day. I was his assistant coach. And that's what I was doing. I was going to be a high school teacher, high school coach. And that was it. That was my path. And then this assistant job at Merrimack opened up, and Bert just called and basically said, what day could you be here? And that was it. But I was on my way to be probably a math teacher and a high school coach.
You coached there for 4 years, right? As an assistant.
Yep.
Okay. Why'd you leave?
I had aspirations to get into Division I, which, as you know, it's not that easy to do, especially when you didn't play at the level. I left and worked. I always worked camps for Rob Kennedy at the Hoop Group. A lot of his, you know, former employees went on to become Division I coaches because of the contacts you make from running the camp and the AAU contacts and high school contacts you gain. So I already figured I had some coaching experience. I went and Rob offered me a job after I worked for him as a counselor at Eastern Invitational, and he offered me a job to be basically the director of Eastern Invitational, which is now called Hoop Group Elite. And, you know, 9 months into that, I got offered an assistant coaching job with Paul Cormier at Dartmouth.
What was Dartmouth like?
Paul Cormier was great. Another old school guy. He just came from the NBA. You know, he was played high school for Raleigh Massimino. He was an assistant for Raleigh at Villanova. He left to take Dartmouth for the first time right before they won the national championship as like a 32-year-old. Then he went to Fairfield. He was in the NBA for a long time, came back a second term at Dartmouth, and that's who I ended up working for. But a little bit different. Ivy League is, you know, obviously the academic hurdles, non-scholarship, right? So you got to do a lot more work as far as research and getting transcripts and figuring out families' financial needs. And before you ever get the yes or the no, there's a lot more that goes into it. But you're obviously around highly successful people, not only in the basketball world, everyone in your hallway and, you know, other athletes you meet. You just meet a lot of highly driven, successful people. You know, from Dartmouth, I went to Robert Morris. Andy Toole, one of my best friends in the world, he got the Robert Morris job at 28, almost hired me the first time. Rob Kennedy convinced him he needed to hire someone older because he was young. So he hired someone over me the first time around, but he said, next time I have an opening, I'm going to hire you. So 18, 20 months later, I went to work for Andy at Robert Morris.
So when you go from Dartmouth, where you have all those challenges, and Dartmouth, like for people who don't know, like Animal House is based upon Dartmouth, right?
Yep.
Is it like that? Is that an accurate portrayal? You talk about Merrimack being a good little party school, kind of 20 minutes north of Dartmouth in the woods, right? Beautiful, yeah. But in the middle of nowhere.
Very cool college town, right? I was not a great place for a 28 to 30 year old single guy. But if you go to school there, or you're, you know, a lot of alums come back and kind of retire, buy houses in that area. There's like, you know, ski slopes and that type of thing. But seemed like a heck of a place to go to school. They have a frat road that if you drove by on a Monday, you just see people cleaning up the whole street. And I think there is some Animal House aspect to it.
Okay, so what was it like to transition to Pittsburgh, working with a friend? Moving, all of those aspects. What do you remember about the first days at Robert Morris?
I came in at you'll like the first days. The team had already left, so it was June. Not a whole lot to do at the time. There wasn't the June events. And I think within like the first 5 days working for Andy, we went to a Bruce Springsteen and a Kenny Chesney concert. And I was like, man, this is great. This is a good life out here in Pittsburgh. Love Pittsburgh as a city. They had a lot of success under Mike Rice and then under Andy. You know, different kid, right? We had a lot of like tough city kids. It was really cool to work for, you know, a Paul Cormier who's kind of at the end of his career and Andy Toole's at the beginning of his career and kind of taking later on in life like aspects of both of their coaching styles. But I love Pittsburgh. I met my wife there, who's now followed me here, obviously. But cool place. Robert Morris, we had a great run in the NEC. They're doing better things in the Horizon League now. And you know, knowing Andy, you know, it won't be long before they're on top of that Horizon League.
Well, there's a couple different aspects to it. First, how'd you meet your wife?
Somewhat blind date. It was Andy's wife, Brooke Toole. One of her, she worked at Dick's Sporting Goods. One of her close friends at work previously worked with my wife at U.S. Steel. And I was like the fifth wheel at a dinner with Andy and his wife and this other couple. And the girl just suggested, hey, I think I got a friend for you. So, you know, it's not blind anymore with internet and Google search and figuring out real quick. It wasn't totally blind. We knew what each other looked like before we got together. But that was how we met, kind of set up through a mutual friend.
First date was where?
First date was at a bar in the south side of Pittsburgh. The local. And I thought we were meeting for dinner. My wife was a little bit nervous, so she decided not to eat. So it was just a couple of drinks. Pittsburgh has a great famous gyro spot called Mike and Tony's. So I was starving. I thought we were going for dinner, and 4 hours later, there was no food involved. So I walked her to her car, and then I went and like slammed two gyros afterwards by myself.
What was her reaction to like, you know, what do you do? And you're like, I'm a college basketball coach.
Yeah. What? She actually thought that I had zero interest in her because the date was in June. And as you know, we're pretty busy in July.
Yeah.
So, you know, 6-7 days after the first date, it was like, hey, by the way, you're basically not going to see me all month. And she thought that was a kind of a cover up
bluff. Yeah.
Blow off. Yeah. But she's with it now. I think at first her and, you know, her family were in that mold of, okay, well, what else do you do? Which I love. You still get that all the time, right? Like, okay, you coach. You're like, what else do you do? Yeah, that's what I do. But she's all in now. She knew nothing about basketball when I met her. Now she always asks me to quiz her during games and, you know, throws out the, you know, foul or defend, or did you see that blob, and tries to kind of make me believe.
I asked this of Amir Abdul-Rahim a couple nights ago. And I ask you, it's they ask you, what else do you do? But there's also when you say you're a college basketball coach, it's almost like when we were kids and you'd say you're a used car salesman.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Like you're in higher education. I'm guessing you probably have a master's degree, right? Like,
yep, I do.
This is a legit profession. And yet somehow in many circles, the perception of it is like something nefarious. Is that fair?
That is fair. And it's almost like the last thing we actually do sometimes is coach basketball, right? Like we're teachers. We are psychiatrists. We are a lot of different things. We don't just, you know, sit there drawing up out of bounds plays all day. But yeah, I still get it all the time. Yeah. What else do you do? What do you teach? Oh, you don't teach? Oh, this time season's over. This must be great. You got all the time in the world. You got 6 months off. It's like, yeah, really. I'm trying to figure out who's going to be on our team next year.
how do we as a basketball community change that perception?
I think we should start a reality show, like a day in the life of. Right. Follow us around for a day or two and with some cameras and different times of the year and, you know, see that our summer vacation isn't so much a teacher's vacation. Right. And again, we have some downtime. I used to love this time of the year before the transfer portal went nuts. And now it's not as you're not as at ease anymore as it used to be after the season. But, you know, August is great. Always take a vacation in August and do have some downtime there, but it really never stops. It's such a long, it's really the only sport, you know, hockey as well, that goes over both semesters. You got the summer term, you coach these guys for 8 months for one season. You know, some of these other sports, even college football, right? They start mid end of August and then it's like 2-3 months later, they're done. You know, ours is a, you know, you got the highs, you got the lows. We were 2-12 at one point and finished the season with 11 straight wins, right? So my wife probably saw me at home in like the low of lows and the high of highs, all within a 2 month period of the emotional roller coaster of being a coach.
2016, the Merrimack jab comes up. And what happened?
A assistant athletic director who, and this is a good message for any younger coaches out there of, always treating people right. Especially within your department or just in life in general, but Brad Davis, who's now the, athletic director at Mercyhurst in Pennsylvania, He was our sports information director when I was an assistant coach. And, you know, he kept climbing and climbing. At the time, he was an assistant athletic director. And, you know, he shot me, I think it was like a direct message on Twitter. I think we were actually on an official visit dinner when I was at Robert Morris and said, hey, I don't know if you heard, the job opened. And, you know, I think you'd be a great candidate. You know, we're trying to go Division One. We had great success here when you were an assistant coach. We're trying to get into the NEC, which is a league that you're basically at the best program in the NEC at the time. You know, he's like, I think between those two things, it would make a lot of sense. So, you know, that's how it started. Probably interviewed, introductory interview with Jeremy Gibson, athletic director, probably 2 weeks after that. And, you know, another visit to campus and ended up getting the job. But, you know, it started through, you know, a former SID who then became an assistant athletic director. And now he's an athletic director himself.
How did you find out you got the job?
I was called back to campus. And I thought it was, I was under the impression that it was a final interview, me and one other candidate. I thought it was, they were bringing two of us back. And, you know, went over to the president's office, which I thought was a final interview. And he basically just offered me the job at the time. And I took it sight unseen. My wife was probably 8 months, 4.5 weeks pregnant at the time.
Wow.
She was up the road at a Starbucks. I called her and said, I got the job. She said, what does it pay? I said, I have no effing idea, but I'm taking it. So I think that was a little nerve wracking. But yeah, that is how I found out.
So you take the job in 2016, your wife gives birth, right?
Yep.
And at that point in time, you know you're going to transition to D1, but you're not yet D1.
Yep.
Okay, so what is that experience like? Take me through what it's like to coach in a program that's a Division II program, going to be Division I. You can still play in the Division II tournament then, but not when you transition to Division I. There's a lot going on there. What's that all like?
So it actually, the timeline, it took a couple years. It wasn't right away. It was, we are in talks. Different conferences were interviewing us. You know, I think the MAC, the NEC both had some campus visits. So we were committed to paying whatever the pay is to go. We were just waiting on a league to invite us. So the first couple of years, we were full blown Division II. And then it wasn't until that last season, that we announced, I think in September, that we accepted an invite to the NEC and then played a whole season after that. So, to be honest, it was the Northeast 10 Division II league is a really, really good league. You know, as you could see from Stonehill's transition this year, they tied for second in our league. We were recruiting a lot of the same type of kids. I was very fortunate. You know, we got three guys from Coach Hurley from St. Anthony. You know, Javaris Hayes was, you would love him. He's got some Doug Gottlieb in him. He was a, almost 2,000 point, close to 900 assists, all-time NCAA steal leader, Division One, Two, or Three. First kid I ever brought to Merrimack as a head coach, 4 years starting point guard, and should have been a Division One player. People missed. I don't know how he was not at, you know, St. Peter's or Wagner or any NEC or MAC school at the time. So it made it easy having a guy like that. We kind of had a generational player who was a senior the first year that we were eligible to be Division One, and that we actually won the regular season NEC championship that year with those three St. Anthony's guys as seniors. So when you have three guys that won, you know, played for a Hall of Fame guy in high school, one went to three straight NCAA Division II tournaments. You know, we upset Northwestern our second game ever in Division One. And a lot of it was like last night with Purdue having the young guards. Northwestern started, I think, two or three freshmen, and we had these old guys that have already won 75 college basketball games, and we're just kind of been there, done that.
Well, don't skip ahead on me. Okay. Yep. So your first year.
Yep.
Who are you as a coach? Right. Cause you sit there,
yeah,
and you know, you've been you know, you played for a great coach. He's got his own style. Then you're with Paul. He's got his own style. Then you're with Andy. He's got his own style. Yeah. Right? Who are you your first year?
I am probably closest to Andy just because it was the most recent. As far as, you know, I was big conditioning tests, and every Tuesday was, you know, we had our conditioning. And
what was your conditioning test?
It was, it's actually, I hope Andy listens to this because he'll make him sound a little soft that he's gone to, they're called 10 and 10s. And I think he's actually lightened his up because the Miami Heats is actually not as hard. It's 10. You got to run 10 lengths of the floor, 5 up and backs in a minute. And then you get a minute off and you got to do it 10 times. And it is, it's brutal. Like the Heat do it. And now Andy gives 2 minutes in between each one. I don't do it anymore. He'll probably call me and tell me I'm soft because of it. We just get in shape by playing basketball. But, you know, I think I was closer to Andy that first year with a little bit of my own personality. We play this zone that now has taken on a life of its own. We played it at Robert Morris for 2 years. He's gone back to man-to-man. It's kind of gotten better and tweaked it every year. And now it's, I don't know if you watched us play, but it's, yeah.
Did you always play the zone though? Like that first year?
Always played it. In 7 years, I bet we've played 25 possessions of man-to-man in 7 years. And that's because we threw some guys in at the end of the game that didn't know certain possessions. I mean, we are full-blown zone and that's it. Right. And I didn't know. Going into it, I had no idea how much of we were going to play. And a lot of it was this kid, Javaris Hayes, who he just stole the ball so well in the zone that we just stayed with it ever since. But yeah, I was trying to find myself. I didn't know what we wanted to do. I worked with Patrick Beilein at Dartmouth, another close friend of mine. We watched every Michigan game because of it. I fell in love with the two guard. So we were a, you know, Syracuse version of 2-3 zone with some John Beilein two guard. And just until we stayed with the two guard stuff, really up until this past year with about 12 games to go, I got a freshman point guard, Javon Bennett, who I just kept watching going, why am I having this kid hit the wing, cut to the corner and waiting to get it back three passes later before we actually kind of do something. So, we went away. We still have the two guard ATOs and stuff like that, but we've opened up a little more. We actually are a lot more, Nevada Smith from Marquette has helped me out a lot. We play a lot more pistol action, spread the floor, a lot more like Marquette nowadays. Sorry to skip it again, but
no, that's great. That's incredible, right? Because we you take pieces of things that, you know, you like, you learn, and you kind of put it together and you put your own twist on it. Just this always is something I've wondered. You're a zone team.
Yep.
But then when you got to run your offense against man to man. So do you even spend time with man concepts when you're in the preseason? Like, how do you handle that? Because you also have to teach the different kinds of man to man defensively to know what your offense is going to go against.
Yeah, that's challenging. I think my first year or two, we did do some shell because of that. And then I decided, like, what the hell are we doing? This 4 minutes of shell a day isn't making us better at man-to-man anyway. I also didn't want the team to think we had a second defense. Like, I wanted them to be all in on the zone and this is what we do, right? So what we do, we try to take a scout team, you know, we'll do different types of ball screen coverages, but I do think it hurts us offensively early in the season because of it. But you just hope you get a bunch of competitive kids that want to win the drill. So they at least try very hard playing man-to-man, but it is that is tough. We play man-to-man in all of our offensive segments. It's not the greatest man-to-man. I try to put a assistant coach in charge of at least like making sure guys are like at the center line and not hugging their man. And, you know, we don't really call fouls. So we kind of just let them beat the shit out of each other to at least help us play a little bit better defense. But it is a struggle.
Well, and then the old expression is, right, that you always press a pressing team because they only used to going against a press. What about your own zone offense, right? I do wonder if it's if guys are so used to your zone, which is different than other zones, does that affect your own zone offense?
It does. To be honest, this year we were great against zone, but in most years I would actually like make fun of my team because when they play against our own zone, right, you know how it is. They want to show coach up. So like they come up with all these little things. Oh, we're going to do that. We're going to slip into the high post. And they're trying to almost like look at me like, yeah, like we'll show you. And then when we go into a game and a man-to-man team goes into a hands up Harry 2-3, they kind of look at it and freeze sometimes. And I'm thinking like, well, what happened to those five guys that were just trying to shred our defense in practice 12 hours ago? So we've gotten better. We have, because of coaching zone, we have two or three things that we would probably do to maybe attack us that we use against other teams. And we keep it very simple. We don't try to go too nuts and have 17 different sets when a team goes zone. We got two or three go-tos, two or three concepts. And we usually get people out of it pretty quick.
You know, what's funny about that is, you remember when Indiana was number one team in the country with Tom Crean. Oh. They played Syracuse in the Sweet 16. And Mike Hopkins was still at Syracuse at the time. And I hop played for my dad in AU, like I've known him forever.
Yeah.
And we were talking about different stuff. And he said, we're not really like they don't at Syracuse, they didn't really scout. They just, you know, they just didn't. And then at halftime, they kind of figure out what you're doing and they'd adjust a little bit. But he said, you know, they're way more talented than us. They're just, he's going to screw it up. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, you know, he's like, if it would have been one day, it was Elite Eight, they would have beat us. They've been fine because you don't have time to put all this stuff in.
Yeah.
You just run zone offense, just play, read, react, you know, go accordingly. But because you have the week off, really smart offensive coaches outthink themselves in trying to put too much stuff in. Like, oh, we're going to run this special, we're going to run that, and just get out of the just general offense, zone offensive concept. Do you find that in teams you go against?
Yeah, I feel the same way. And you almost see everything new they're going to try, you see within the first 4-minute media, right? Everyone tries to get you on a lob, like second play of the game. And, you know, they think it's the greatest thing ever. But yeah, I think that one day prep and teams that really just kind of ball are the teams you struggle against the most. You know, those, you know, different sets and overthinking it is not what you want to do. You end up just turning the ball over.
What's up? I'm John Wall.
And I'm CJ Toledano, and we're starting a new podcast presented by DraftKings called Point Game. Everyone, please welcome Coach John Calipari.
We're getting beat by 18, my first game in Kentucky. They're saying Cal's a bust. He can't coach. This is crazy. John Wall runs down the floor and makes a buzzer beater.
Yep.
You remember that, John?
That's my first game win I ever made. Remember you said you never seen me do that.
Ladies and gentlemen, DeMarcus Boogie Cousins.
I called Boogie. I'm like, yo, bro, I'm about to commit to Duke. And I hung up on him. Bro, I'm talking about, do you want to tell me how many times he called me all type of names? Bro, you really sold me out. You doing this.
Bro, I was sick. I remember that like yesterday, man.
Love you, John Wall.
Thanks, Coach. Love you, too.
You made me everything I am today.
Nah, you made me. You made me.
I love it. Check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, DraftKings YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It wasn't even supposed to be my game.
That's my game.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
So you get the job.
Yep.
How'd you decide to put together your staff? Remember, you're still D2 budget, right?
Yep.
And D2 rules. How'd you put together your staff?
So I only, at the time, it's one full-time assistant. And Mickey Burtnick, who was there working for Coach Hamill, who I replaced, he played when I was an assistant. So it was kind of a no-brainer. It was just keep the guy that was there. He was familiar with the school. I knew him very well. Recruited a lot of the players on the team, and it was just, you know, the easiest transition. And then I brought Dave Richards with me as kind of a volunteer, and he was our ops guy at Robert Morris. He's now a really successful Division III head coach. I brought him with me from Pittsburgh and helped him get a permanent sub teaching job to kind of supplement some income. So that was my initial staff, just a guy who I coached and was already there, and, you know, brought a guy with me from Robert Morris.
When did you know official? When was it official that you're going to Division I?
It wasn't until, so I guess September of that first season was 1920. September of 19. I mean, there was a couple, you know, there was like a fall meeting where we thought we were going to get the year before, where we thought we were going to get the invite, and they just kind of pushed it back. And then there was a spring meeting, and, you know, all signs were pointing towards us getting in. But it took a couple meetings for whatever reason for us to finally get the invite. So it wasn't until, it would have been 18, fall of 18. And then we finished that last Division II year. And then 1920 was our first year of, you know, the transition phase.
So when we teach me about the transition phase, because I think there's so much unknown about
it. Yeah.
So you knew the year before?
We knew the year before. We knew September the year before. So we played a whole season knowing that we were going to go. And it's, you know, it's the hardest part about it is the recruiting piece, right? You got to sell to kids. You know, there were almost kids that would almost rather go Division II, right? Because I want to go play for something, right? You're each year got easier. Okay. The first class, you'll never get the chance to play in an NCAA tournament. The second class, you'll have a chance your senior year, junior year, et cetera. So the toughest part was the recruiting piece. To be honest, I think the reaction people thought I would have about not being able to play in the NCAA tournament, if we did this pod the first year when we won the regular season, I didn't find out we weren't eligible for the NIT until about 3 weeks left in the season. Right. I think I would have had a little bit different take on that, because this rule we knew, you know, I was preaching to my team all year, like, we're going to win this regular season. We're going to go to the NIT. Who cares about the NCAA? We're going to go to the NIT. And I don't know who it was that let me know, but with about 3 weeks left in the year and us fighting for a regular season championship, I that year had to inform the team, like, hey, guys, even if we win, we can't go to the NIT. And we did win the regular season championship that year. That was a little bit harder because we didn't know that rule. I thought, you know, some of our biggest wins at Robert Morris were in the NIT. We beat Kentucky. We beat St. John's. I thought, hey, first year of transition, first team ever to win a regular season championship in their first year of Division I. Let's go to the NIT and play some unmotivated high major that doesn't want to be there, and we'll knock them off too and have some fun. And then, you know, with that felt, now that was the COVID years. There was no postseason. But that felt a little bit more like the rug was pulled out from under us versus 4 years later when kind of already been there, done that.
I forgot that you were that was your staff. You were at when you guys beat Kentucky in the NIT.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was that like?
Yeah, that was awesome. The coolest thing about that was Andy called me and he said, hey, I don't know what's going on, but, you know, ESPN2 or whatever it is, they want me to be on a call on the selection show for the NIT. He goes, something's up. Why would they want to talk to me? And what it was I think Rupp was being used for the NCAA. Coach Cal is from Moon Township. I think his grandmother worked in the cafeteria at Robert Morris. So there was this whole story of, like, Cal said, whatever, we'll go play at Robert Morris. It was like a homecoming. I mean, their practice had 150 of his former cronies there hanging out, watching their practice. So that was like a homecoming for Cal. We had a home game, and it was wild. You know, we had, I remember our secretary at the time telling us she had like 7,000 voicemails of Big Blue Nation looking for tickets. And, you know, she was used to getting 8 calls for tickets. You know, our players were out about 3.5 hours before that game. I thought they were going to wear themselves out, how pumped they were for that game. And then we, you know, it was same deal. We started 11-0, and it was almost like oh shit, what did we just get ourselves into? We got this pissed off team that got upset in their conference tournament versus this Kentucky team who is getting, you know, slandered because they didn't make an NCAA tournament. And, you know, I don't know if they knew exactly what, you know, all of a sudden you got this 2,800 seat place with 3,500 people there. I mean, their players looked like they were 9 feet tall in this place. And, yeah, it was awesome. It was one of the greatest nights as a coach I've ever been a part of.
I can't imagine the buzz afterwards. You can't sleep. You know, you're watching it on ESPN on replay. Like, it's the energy that you walk away with, and then eventually that adrenaline wears off, and you're just exhausted.
Exhausted. Yeah, yeah. Andy said he felt like when Apollo, was it Rocky II or one, when Apollo calls Rocky and says, like, I want to fight you in Philadelphia, you know, that was kind of who we were when Cal basically challenged us to a game in Moon Township.
That's a very good analogy. So coming into this year, what'd you think of your team?
So we were preseason number one in the league. Well, a lot of that, we had the preseason player of the year. We probably just kind of had the most known, right? The most returning that people actually knew about. You know, leagues like ours now, you're never going to be able to figure out who's the best team because there's so much, you know, it's sad, but there's so much coming and going every year. I was a little bit nervous because we lost two transfer guards to the portal. So we had zero guard experience, but the best front court in the league coming back. So I was a little nervous about that. Our non-conference schedule was absolutely brutal because of some prior success. Nobody wants to play us anymore. So I was, you know, worried about that. We're going to get beat up a little bit in the non-conference. We got these freshman guards who are going to think like, their confidence is going to be shot by the time we get to conference play. We start out, we didn't win a Division I game until after the new year. So all that stuff was taking its toll on me a little.
Well, let's go back to that. What is it like at your level to lose guys to the portal? Because it's like your first point guard you have, right? You get a steal. You get a kid who should be Division I. He goes Division II. Yep. But if that happens now, he's probably gone.
Gone. I mean, if you look now, and a lot of these kids are not going to find schools, any kid that averages 10 points or more in Division II now, they automatically go in the portal. I mean, it's the trickle down, every level down you get, it's getting worse. The only saving grace is you can find some kids yourself, right? And you just got to adjust to that. You can't get emotional about it. You can't overreact. You know, there's plenty of good players out there. I'd love to keep all our guys for 4 years. I think that's one of the coolest things about coaching is seeing these kids grow, but it's become so much more of a year-to-year thing. You know, we lost two guards. The other thing, I can't wait. Someone should write a story in about 5 years from now. These kids are making horrible mistakes. Like, you know, we have a guy in the portal right now who was the player of the year in our conference. And I told him, you better be careful. Because if all of a sudden you go to a higher level and you average 6-7 points a game versus back-to-back player of the year in our conference, let people say that you would be the guy that could play at that level. Like, your pro stock can really get hurt by almost exposing yourself and admitting that you're the third best player on your own team. So I think a couple years from now, there's going to be a lot more stories of why the heck did I do that versus I made a great choice. But it just makes the off season a lot, you know, you stare at your phone and go, okay, who's going to text me today saying, hey coach, could we meet tomorrow morning? Like, that's cue for, I'm leaving. And you know, that
do they all at least call you and meet with you?
Yeah, they do. And I have awesome kids. You know, the kid even and he's good and he can play at a higher level. And it was emotional. He was emotional in telling me that he was leaving. And I actually have no He spent 4 years with us. He got a degree from Merrimack. I actually have no problem with that. He's a fifth year guy because of the COVID year. Like, you know, go see what's out there and see what you could do. But, you know, a lot of these guys, you know,
or you could hold every record,
or you could hold every record, right? Be back. Like the days of like our Hall of Fames at school just going to go away because no one really attaches themselves to a place as much anymore, right? Honestly, if I asked every guy on my team who their favorite NBA team is, they'll tell me they all just follow players now, right? There's like no,
totally,
you know, like I'm a Knicks fan. John Starks.
It's interesting because, but what they don't get is not just the bad decisions, but it's like, okay, are we going to invite him back for the alumni game?
Yeah.
You know, are you going to look at your path? Obviously you weren't a conference player of the year, but wherever you play the longest, especially where you feel that's like your basketball family. Yep. That's where you're going to get jobs from. That's where you're going to, and I can't imagine cutting that off. That just seems so foolish. And wherever you go to, like, you're not really in their family if you're there for 9 months.
No, nope.
Right? You're kind of a mercenary.
You might not be after 3 months. Like you have, if you got 1 year, you got July, September, and October to prove yourself before that lineup set. Like you could be 3 months from now saying, what the hell did I do?
Yeah, it's really crazy. Okay, so here's the question with this year. You mentioned you didn't win a Division I game. Wasn't just that. I think I was looking, and you didn't even have – you weren't really close, no. Right? The Sacred Heart game was close. I think there was one other one. Sacred Heart and Maine.
Yep.
Lost to Maine at home, right? The rest of them weren't close.
Weren't close.
So then you get to conference play. And it's the level of competition you can compete in.
Yep.
But how do you teach how do you rebuild their confidence that they can win? But also, how do you teach them to win when you haven't been in those? You talk about your college coaches, everything was time and score. Like they're not used to having a lead in the last 5 minutes of the game. No. How do you teach that?
Yeah, that main game was a perfect example of it. We just had no idea how to win yet. FDU. Very first conference game of the year, we were controlling the whole game. We were up 10 in the second half. And as soon as they took the lead, our timeout looked like just a bunch of blank stares, like, here we go again. Right. And it was
right. Where at least their kids, and here's where they get the benefit of having the three transfers up. They'd won.
They'd
at a Division II level. So they know how to win. They know what it takes. You don't have to teach that. Whereas your kids, and obviously you're going to get some other kids from other program, but as a group, they hadn't won. Hadn't won for you.
No, they hadn't won. You know what? It was, we didn't change anything we did. It was, we did have some seniors that have had some success that we needed them to take a little bit of a step up. We had talented young guys and veterans that were kind of, you know, I give them credit. The last 11 games, they really stepped up and acted like seniors, but they were taking a little too much of a back seat for my liking and just kind of going along for the ride. And it was like, I brought them in. I said, hey, guys, you won a championship as freshmen when you were gravy. You were just kind of a passenger on the bus. We need you to drive this thing now and give some of these younger guys confidence and make them believe. And I'll give our older guys credit. You know, people also don't, when you look, our kid who's leaving, who was the player of the year in the conference, he missed seven games in the non-conference. So that's 18-9 we didn't have. Then we bring him back, right? And now you got to figure out again how to play with him. So sure. Our schedule was tough. We weren't playing great, but there was a lot more. There was a lot more internal stuff that people you can't really quantify, you know. And then once we got it all together, right? Like, for instance, he didn't play. He plays 32 minutes a game at the five. We got to take, I don't trust our freshman young bigs yet. We got to take our four man and move him to the five in the zone. Then we got to take one of our guards and move him to the wing. And you just kind of, all this shit you worked on since July, everybody's playing different positions. And the way we play defensively, that doesn't work well. You got to kind of master what you do. So some of it was just actually getting our team together that was going to be our team. But then like one win led to another and guys started believing and You know, our freshmen, we started two freshman guards, right? And I think even Andy Toole's the one who said to me, he goes, wait till they hit, I think he said, the 500-minute mark. You know, once you played 500 career college minutes, you've played a lot of basketball. You become a completely different person. And our two guards, Javon Bennett and Jordan Durkak, you would have thought they were juniors or seniors by the end of the year. And they were just, you know, two 18, 19-year-old kids.
You get ready for the tournament. And now you guys are winning. You kind of got it rolling. Mm-hmm. But it's a tournament that if you win it, first, how'd you get to play in the tournament? Like, what is that? Right?
Yeah.
Like, I was sitting there going, like, why are they letting them play in the tournament? That doesn't make any sense.
I know. Some other leagues started to do it. Like Bellarmine
did
the same thing, right? This becomes a little more of a story because FDU actually won the game. But Atlantic Sun did it. There was another conference or two that did it. I give our conference credit. They're kind of putting your neck out there a little bit. And what they did is change the rule. And after your second year now, you're at least eligible to play in the conference tournament. You know, they kind of did it as like a student-athlete thing, student-athlete experience. We're not going to have a kid go through his whole career without having to at least play in the conference tournament. So I do give Noreen Morris, the commissioner of the NECA, a lot of credit for, you know, kind of putting her neck on the line and allowing us to play in the tournament.
And Ashley is like a genius. Yeah. I knew it all along. No problem. No, just on the same team. Yeah. Did you give him? Was there a special speech or message about, hey, why we want to win this tournament? Like just to prove that this rule is dumb or anything? Was there? There had to have been a speech there.
We were playing so well, right? That was 8 in a row. I didn't want to mess with anything. It was just like next game, next game, next game. I truly believed the way we were playing that nobody could beat us. I didn't need any, you know, we had this powwow after we lost to FDU at home before we won the 11 straight, and we kind of righted the ship, and the guys just took ownership over this thing that I stayed out of the way. I didn't want to, like, they didn't need one from the Gipper. It was, they kind of took this us against the world mentality, and I just kind of, you know, called a few plays, did one of these to get back on defense a couple times, and just kind of sat there and watched these guys really go out there and perform.
What was it like to win the conference tournament championship?
Yeah, it was awesome. On the home floor, we just redid. We've been Division I hockey for years. We have a great little hockey arena that holds about 3,500 seats. Our gym itself is just kind of like a bigger, not even high school gym. We've transitioned to playing more games in this Lawler Arena. It was awesome with, you know, 200 courtside seats, a couple bars set up, $2 drafts for students. And when that last ball missed, I kind of just froze. I didn't really know what to do. I saw the poor kid, Dimitri Roberts, who's a hell of a player, you know, right in front of me, down on his knees, kind of picked him up, told him how much, you know, I respect him and what he's done over the year, go get a win for the league, and kind of just froze. And it's cool to me to see everybody else celebrate. I bust one of my assistants' balls a little bit now because, you know, he ran out and joined the pylon like a player, and then he realized, oh, shit, I'm a coach, and he kind of got back in line. But emotions are emotions, and you can't hold back what you're doing at the time. And but for me, it was just kind of taking all in. I saw my wife and my son 3 minutes later. Our guys ran and stole the trophy out of the commissioner's hands and started running around with it. And I don't think anyone at that time, nobody cared that we were not going to an NCAA tournament. It was like, we just won a championship. We just won our second championship in 2 weeks. And you know, we'll probably realize this when we turn on the TV and see we're not there. But our celebration, our locker room after, our happiness was no different.
The tournament's about matchups, right? And everybody made a big deal about their size, yep, or lack thereof. But having seen Purdue and thought about them, it's not just that they press, but also they got older dudes going against a freshman backcourt. Yep. I was struggling with if there was a chance, if there was a way. Did you see a path to them beating Purdue?
Not really. No. I thought it would be tough. I didn't take into account the freshman guards on Purdue because, you know, when you're playing a pressing team, you can get some easy stuff on the other end if you're smart, like at the end of the press. And I just thought with their size in the front court, it would be like, you know, break the pressure. You know, you don't want to necessarily break the pressure, hit ahead, and just take kind of hit ahead threes and take the bait all the time. I thought they were just kind of get some lob dunks and some easy stuff. But yeah, you don't really think about that at the time. Like, okay, yeah, they're high major guys, but they're freshmen. And these kids, I mean, this kid Roberts, he is a hell of a player. He won probably 90 Division II games and another 20 games this year. Like when it got close, I'm thinking this is going to be interesting because he's also a guy. It's either like he's going to make or he's going to miss. He's so quick. He's got step back. He's got shots off the bounce. He gets fouled. He's kicking his feet. He's throwing his body around. He's a tough, tough guard. So when this thing got close, I was like, man, this is going to be like a make or miss Dimitri Roberts game. And FDU has a real chance to win this thing. But going in, I'd be lying if I said they had a chance.
The challenge for them is the same challenge for you that you have, not just for your roster, but yourself personally, right? But for you, like, this is different.
Yeah.
You were played at Merrimack. You were an assistant at Merrimack. You've helped win at Merrimack in Division II. Now you've won to Merrimack at Division One. What's the challenge like for you in terms of what you do, how your career trajectory goes?
Yeah, I think the ultimate goal is to you know, I'd love for our brackets to be going out next year in a million different offices and seeing our name on it. When I signed a contract after the first championship, it was a pretty long contract. And, you know, Merrimack, our athletic director, Jeremy Gibson, and Chris Hopi, our president, you know, I basically said to them, like, I would love for this to be my first. Let's make this long term where this is not only my first, but also my second Division I job, right? The first one being the transition, the second one being like, let's add to this thing. And, you know, just last week, there's contractors in looking at how to upgrade the locker room. You know, we buy a court, we move over to the hockey arena. So it is transitioned into being my second job, in a place I love. And, I'd like to see us on a bracket.
Are you going to go to the garden? Are you going to watch in the garden? Like if they, you know, what would it be like if they advance to play in the Sweet 16 for you?
I don't think I will go. more so, I got, you know, I have a.
You could be. Is it Brian Winklevoss? You're kind of the. Remember the other guy, yeah, who was the Ryan Seacrest had the other host, yep, on Idol.
Yep.
That's kind of your role right now. You're the guy who actually won the league and won the tournament.
Yeah, I, like I said, I think the more they win, the more our name keeps going out there. I actually appreciate you. You actually pronounce it right. Everyone else is like, it says Merrimack, like Merry Christmas, and you hit it right on with Merrimack. But I have a 6 and a 2-year-old. I'm away from home enough. I'm not going to make that trip to the garden. I'd be much happier sitting on my couch, drinking a beer, playing my son one-on-one in between commercials, and you know, rooting for them and watching and hoping their run continues. But I will not be there in person.
Last thing and most important thing, behind you, it looks like you're in your basement.
Yep.
And my probably identifying the basement, which like looks like the boys' fun room, playroom. They got a little bunk, yep, bed. Do you take it easy on them on the little hoop on the door? Do you take it easy on them, or do you go full speed? Are they allowed? You just Dikembe Mutombo every time they try and score.
I hate to say this, but I rarely win. I rarely win. I think I'll give it another. He'll be 7 in June. I'll give him another I don't know, a couple of years before I actually start trying, but he, it's been awesome. The last year, he's huge Celtics guy. I'm from Jersey. I don't have the accent. His starting with daycare up through now. I mean, that you'd think the kids from South Boston.
All right, John.
You ask my son who his favorite player is, and he tells you Marcus Smart. He's all Boston all day. So I do take it easy on him, but I think that'll change in the next couple of years.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate this.
Thanks, Doug.
How good was that, right? I mean, it's got to be hard sitting in your basement, kids running around, and you're watching after you kind of live your life. It's a tough one. It's a tough one. But Joe's a really good coach with a really good program. It seems to have a really good balance about it. My thanks so much to Joe for spending all this time with us on a Saturday. My thanks to you for downloading it. Reminder, the Doug Gottlieb Show is available daily, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, 12 to 2 Pacific. Keep listening, keep downloading. If you have any questions, at Gottlieb Show, hit me up. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.